Je m'occuperai de votre car plus tard.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, Ned Ludd and Captain Swing. Ned Ludd and Captain Swing, of course, both... are you with me? Are you with me? Are we ready? Rock and roll? Yep. Yep. Ned Ludd and Captain Swing. Okay. Interesting idea then. First of all, in some ways, completely different from the movement we looked at last week. Social movements always have something in common. They always find it difficult to decide how to organize. They always find it difficult to get everybody in agreement on the exact objectives. Gradual abolition and mitigation, immediate emancipation. You've got to choose. Should you be more moderate and try to get more people in? Who is the most important people to address yourself to? These are general problems for all social movements, and certainly in this section. But this movement perhaps is as different as you can imagine from the previous one. Remember the characteristics of the movement against slavery. A combination, really a political movement, petitions, leaflets, pamphlets, arguments, newspapers, etc., linked ideologically but not practically to the slave revolts in the colonies. There was no practical, they did not organize to send guns and money to the slaves. This is normally because the slave revolts were very quick. They had to explode and they had to win or lose immediately, so there was no time for that. And this also, the result of this also was that in Britain, the anti-slavery movement did not have a big problem with repression. Yeah, their leaders were not executed. Yeah, the leaders of the anti-slavery movement in Britain. Of course, the slaves had the biggest problem you can imagine with repression, because it was not illegal to kill a slave just because you wanted to. So that, you know, you can't imagine a repression thing different from that. Okay, so the movement we're going to look at this week, Ned Ludd and Captain Swing, or rather the series of movements. Ned Ludd being the imaginary leader of the 1811-1812 revolt, and Captain Swing being the imaginary leader of the revolt in the 1930s, completely different. First of all, it's not in the towns. The abolition of slavery movement was fundamentally in the towns, and found its initial support in educated religious people to found it, and then the practical support in the working class towns of the north, the industrial towns, the people who were trying to form trade unions, the radicals and so on. That was the anti-slavery movement. This is completely different. Not in the towns. Ned Ludd and Captain Swing are fundamentally not in the towns. I mean, there are towns involved. But at its biggest point, it's in a lot of small villages. And secondly, rather than beginning by founding an organization, there isn't an organization, there isn't an official national organization for these things. Huh? What's more, their famous leaders, Ned Ludd and Captain Swing, are imaginary. Okay, I imagine, because of course it is essential to be anonymous. You cannot have an official national leader because he won't be official national leader for very long. Okay, so completely different situation. Much bigger problem with repression. Much bigger problem also with literacy. Many people could not read and write in the villages, the agricultural labourers and so on. Really different in many, many ways from the other social movements. So does it have something in common? Well, one thing it has in common is that for a long time we didn't know much about it. It was kind of hidden history for a long time until a Frenchman and an Englishman, I think he's French anyway, Mr. Hudet and Mr. Hobsbawm, English, very English gentleman. He's still alive, actually. He's the grand old man of English historiography, Eric Hobsbawm. And Georges Hudet, who I imagine is French. I know nothing about him except that his name is Georges Hudet, so he's probably French. And they wrote in the 1980s, I think, the book Captain Swing. And what they did is they spent, you know, like 7-8 years in churches looking at very, very old documents, which was probably not interesting every day, you know. The whole thing about writing history books is that sometimes you spend a week looking at old documents and you find nothing interesting at all. Yeah? And then sometimes, of course, you find wonderful things. And so that's something it had in common, perhaps, with the anti-slavery movement, though it was not very well known. But afterwards, once this book, Captain Swing, came out, you got much more interest in it, and a whole series of books on Luddism, a whole series of books on Captain Swing, the most famous one recently being Captain Swing in Kent and Sussex. I'm not sure about the title, but that's the famous one. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. Let's do a little bit of, well, let me do a little bit of a chronological thingy about this. First of all, then, the Luddites, Ned Ludd, or as they often refer to him as, General Ludd. So, if you're going to have an imaginary leader, well, we don't want him to be Sergeant Ludd, do we? No, General Ludd, yes. So, interesting, a military title, yeah? So there was no doubt in the minds of the Luddites that this was going to be a physical question, a question of arms, to some extent at least. Although a very small number of people were killed at these things. I think there are 5 or 6 people killed across the country. It does happen. But the aim is not to have a military confrontation. For a good reason, the agricultural labourers are not stupid. And if you have, on the one hand, agricultural labourers, on the other side, the army, the agricultural labourers always lose. So they say, oh, no, let's not have a military confrontation because the army are better at this than we are. But in our minds, will be General Ludd, yeah, a symbol of the nobility and dignity and power of our movements. To some extent, perhaps you saw the picture, which I put on my website, of the leader, the imaginary picture of the imaginary leader, and it was a man dressed as a woman, interestingly enough. This is another thing, that in some of the riots, they included in the riots elements of carnival, of men dressing up as women. And this is very interesting psychologically. It's about we have to act in a completely different way to make our lives better, and so we are prepared to reject also a lot of other things. And so you have the whole riots of men. You see, the men had to be disguised for the riots because it's dangerous. Yeah? If you get caught, you could be hung. And one of the ways they disguise themselves, which is also have fun at the same time, is to disguise themselves as women. Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting things going on in their heads, some of which we'll never know. The Luddites then, this gave the name Luddites, the Luddism Luddites, and the word has a very sad history afterwards, because today in English, a little, much less in French, I think it can be used in French, but in English, anybody who is opposed to new technology is called in the popular language, oh, he's just a Luddite, yeah? People who refuse to have mobile phones or who think that more 20 years ago, people who thought that, television is a terrible thing and computers are making our lives much worse. Yeah? We say Luddites, which is very, very, very unfair, because in fact, the Luddites were not opposed to new technology. They were opposed to particular machines which they thought were making lives much more difficult for them. Yeah, so it wasn't. It's not. It was really a piece of almost defamation to say, oh well, it was because they didn't understand the machines. A section of the intellectual believe that, but it's not really a very accurate way of doing it. So how does it all begin? Well, the expression that Houdet and Hobsbawm use is collective bargaining by riots. This is the expression they used to explain what the Luddites and many others around that time were doing, collective bargaining by riots. La négociation collective en utilisant les émeutes. Okay? So it's very, very simple. You go to see the person in question, say, would you like to increase our wages or would you like us to have a riot? Huh? That's what it is. This is not so surprising. The riot was very, very common, very, very common. Every few years there were some riots. People did not see any alternatives because, of course, they couldn't vote. And for many of them, they didn't demand the vote. The vote is something for rich people. Why would we demand the vote? There's not a democratic culture. And even the elites often accepted. They were not always very hard on rioters, because the elite often said, oh, well, riots is part of, it's the way things happen. It reminds me of in France, the farmers, the small farmers, from time to time, they do quite spectacular events. And it seems that the media and the government can say, well, that's life. it's not systematically denounced. And the riots were like that. They could be quite acceptable. Now these go on throughout the 18th century. So before that, this is the background. Before, for example, in 1718 and in 1724, there are a series of riots. The weavers, which is the Hong Kong, the weavers threaten to burn the boss's house, yeah, if they don't get what they want. Yeah, so it's collective bargaining by riots, and food riots in 1757, 1766. So it's not rare, yeah, 1795, widespread food riots. These are the years when I'm writing them in French, actually. I should really write them in English, of course. Sorry, I can't do it anymore. 1795. That's in English, and that's in French, but I've been so long in France that I do it in French now. So, well-organized riots. People get arrested, of course. But quite often, widespread public sympathy. A lot of people in the area think, well, what else can they do? They have nothing to eat. You know, it's acceptable. So, which brings us up to the 19th century, and the biggest wave of Bloodism, the first wave of Bloodism, the biggest wave of Bloodism is 1811 to 1812. Yeah, remember that Bloodism was a label claimed by some of the rioters, but also sometimes just attacked from the outside. Yeah, so it's a whole series of riots. Not all of them knew they were Luddites, but we use the word Luddites, especially if there is machine breaking involved. Machine breaking is the center of Luddism, breaking the machine. Most of the people involved in Luddism were workers at home. Yes. The first big wave of machine breaking, the first big wave of Luddism. Yeah. This is the background, riots of different sorts, but the first big wave is 1811. Notice then, of course, you immediately understand the political context, don't you? Yes, good. Okay, the Napoleonic Wars. Yeah, Napoleonic Wars going on. Napoleon trying to block Britain. Difficult to, food prices going up because of the blockade, etc. Okay. Now, the people who were involved in Luddism were the home workers, the people who worked at home. That is, the traditional system, the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, where every week the boss brings round a pile of cotton and takes away a lot of cloth, or every month or something. Yeah. Working at home, not in the factories. So workers on piecework working at home, but working for an employer. So everybody works at home, you all work at home. Every Friday I will bring you some cotton, and every Thursday my employee will come and take away the cloth. So what do you use as machines? Simple machines in your house. The people involved in Luddism were not opposed to some of the machines. For example, they welcomed the spinning jenny. The spinning jenny, look it up in a dictionary, is one of the first machines, which means it's only about this big. And it's much easier to, you can work much faster. This was not a problem because it was small enough to use at home. It was not so expensive. However, when at the end of the 18th century, the new machine came in, the water frame, the Luddites hated the water frame. They hated the water frame because it is a factory machine. It does not help you produce at home. It competes. Yeah, it competes against you. And this kind of the water frame uses a water wheel, moulin à eau. And of course, you don't have one of these at home. It's the first factories are based around water power. Remember, this is before steam power. Before steam power, water power. This is very, 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 very important. This means that the water frame could make one person work 20 times quicker. You could run 20 machines at once. Yeah. So it was impossible for the home worker to compete. Today, when we have a new invention, immediately the new invention is everywhere. When they invent a new mobile phone, the following year, all the companies are selling it. At the time, things moved much, much slower. So when you find the date of the invention of the water frame, in the 1770s, it takes 50 years before it's everywhere. Very, very slow process of getting out. And so this will lead to different kinds of riots. First riots in 1779 against the Water Frame. In 1802 in Wiltshire, more organisation against the new machines. Also in 1802, another machine, the gig mill. Don't ask me what a gig mill is. I have no idea. I am not an expert in the history of technology. But the gig mill was a machine which made the factories much more effective. And so the home workers, the people who worked at home, made life harder for them. They could not compete. And so there was different kinds of protest against the gig mill. In 1805, there was a petition to Parliament, and there was a bill in Parliament, a projet de loi, a bill in Parliament to make gig mills illegal, but it was not successful, and in fact, gig mills were very quickly generalised. Interesting point then, at the beginning, people really believed that it was possible for the government to make a certain new technology illegal. Yeah. Well, in fact, it's very, very difficult. We know now that it's very, very difficult when governments try to do this. Yeah, even if you look at downloading music, yeah, le téléchargement illégal, le gouvernement, it's very, very interesting, very, very difficult. A similar sort of situation, but much, 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 much earlier. So, petition to Parliament, then the beginning of the, in 1811, yes, then the beginning of breaking the machines. Breaking the machines. New method, let's break the machines. That's how we will protect the home workers, we will protect our standard of living. Over a thousand machines were broken. Over a thousand machines were broken in this period. So, what's the situation? Yes, terrible hardship for the home workers. Very, very often these home workers would also work on agriculture. They work in agriculture a few days and then at home they'd be spinning. It's very much mixed. You don't yet have an established working class in the factories. You have people working at home. Everybody works, yeah? If you're 4 years old, you work in the family. Yeah? You've got to work. Work has to happen, and so a lot of mix. And the most famous of the Luddite revolts were in Nottinghamshire. In Nottinghamshire, they were against a particular machine, the stocking frame. The stocking frame. Alors, il s'agit de la fabrication de bas. Which again are what people wore at the time instead of socks. Again, today we don't normally have any problem buying socks, but it's a major industry, the sock industry. The socking industry is a major industry, and so that was the beginning of it. Methods. It was fairly easy for the Luddites to smash the frames because they were extremely small. Factories. It was a factory like a shop with two or three machines, and it was fairly easy for the Luddites to arrive and smash the machines and disappear. Every night for 3 months, the Luddites, guerrilla groups, would train and march and smash the machines and then disappear into the night. The government sent soldiers. It was impossible to stop the Luddites because nobody knew where they were going to be. Remember, there's no street lighting, yeah, it's completely dark. The local people know exactly where everything is. The soldiers who arrive from London or somewhere else, they are completely lost. Yeah? And so it's a very, very easy thing to do, breaking machines and these things. One of the local magistrates reported, houses are broken into by armed men. Many stocking frames are destroyed. The lives of those who oppose are threatened. Arms are seized, sacks are fired, burnt, and private property destroyed. There is an outrageous spirit of tumult and riots. But that's what the magistrates said, who were rather unhappy. One of the Luddites wrote a song about this. At the time, people wrote songs about A lot of very, very popular songs about Robin Hood, Robin des Bois, of course, and loads of them. And here is a Luddite song, Chant, I don't know the tune, I'm afraid. Chant no more your old rhymes about bold Robin Hood. His feats I but little admire. I will sing the achievement of General Ludd, now the hero of Nottinghamshire. Brave Ludd was to measures of violence unused, till his sufferings became so severe that at last to defend his own interest he roused and for the great work did prepare. So interesting there, because that's actually a song by the Luddites, and you can see that they feel a need to justify the violence. They say, we don't like violence, but we have to, in the song. Yeah? So obviously you can see something of the psychology at the time, that people at that time too thought that violence is something, you know, that is, you know, probably a sin, because they had a very religious view of life, and so they felt necessary to justify it, and also felt necessary to explain who was the enemy and who was not the enemy. So here's another Luddite poem. The guilty may fear, but no vengeance he aims at the honest man's life or estate. His wrath is entirely confined to wide frames and to those that old prices abate. That is, that if you're honest and you don't reduce the prices that you pay to your workers, then you'll be okay. That's what they're saying. Yeah? They're saying, you know, it's just that sort of situation. Some of the workers, the home workers, organised to send a petition to Parliament, but the government was clearly not on the side of the Luddites here. Things got stronger. Things got more violent in a way. And in April 1812, in Yorkshire, in West Horton. So this is a movement which goes through a few counties. Yeah, a few counties. It's not as big as the Captain Swing movement, but it's not a local movement. They went to the West Horton and they burnt the mill. Yeah, they burnt the factory. They burnt the factory, interesting case of tactics here, because some of the people who burnt the factory were later found to be agents provocateurs, as we say in English, we say in French, that they were agents of the government who were encouraging people to be extremists, so it was possible for the police to come, for the army to come and arrest them. One of the members of parliament said, as to the persons who had blackened their faces and disfigured themselves for the purposes of concealment and had attended the meeting on Dean Moor near Manchester, it turned out that 10 of them were spies sent out by the magistrates. These spies were the very ringleaders of the mischief and incited the people to acts which they would not otherwise have thought of. And that's what the Member of Parliament said in Parliament in 1812. The government then, obviously under pressure from the people who owned the machines, very unhappy, with this difficulty that sending soldiers was not effective, and so they passed a new law, and the new law was that breaking a machine became a capital offence. So after in 1811, at the end of 1811, a new law said you could be executed if you broke a machine. And interestingly enough, this did not really stop the really desperate people, and this did not really stop the situation. In March 1812, 7 Luddites were sentenced to transportation for life. Yeah, they were sent on holiday to Australia. Well, not a nice holiday to the prison camps in Australia. This law was passed. During this law that made machine breaking a capital offence, Lord Byron, one of the famous English poets, spoke in the House of Lords in opposition to this law. And here is what he said: "Is there not blood enough upon your penal code that more must be poured forth to ascend to heaven and to testify against you? How will you carry this bill into effect? Can you commit a whole country to their own prisons? Will you erect a gibbet in every field and hang up men like scarecrows? Or will you proceed by decimation are these the remedies for a starving and desperate populace? And Byron, in 1816, a few years later, wrote in one of his poems, "Down with all kings except King Lud." Yeah, so General Lud was sometimes King Lud. So, in any case, then the situation continues for a few more months, especially in Nottinghamshire. Very big rewards are proposed for people who denounce the Luddites. And interestingly enough, in Nottinghamshire, they couldn't find anybody to denounce the Luddites. Yeah, so there was this shows that there was a very wide general support for a desperate campaign. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of cases where the employers, the very small employers who had two or three employees, would help the Luddites to break their own machines. Now this is interesting, and this is really, I think, that some of the small employers say, well, listen, if you're going to break all the machines in this region, okay, that's fine by me. I can see I don't want people to be so poor they can't eat. And if you break everybody else's machines, well, it's okay, you can break mine, because then the competition will not destroy me. Yeah, so there's this kind of very old traditional ideas of natural justice. Yeah. So you actually get where the Luddites arrive and the employer says, oh yes, yeah, yeah, go ahead, break my machine. Yeah, this is kind of a little strange situation. Charlotte Bronte, the famous, the extremely famous novelist, wrote about an attack on William Cartwright's mill near Huddersfield in her novel, Shirley. And that is where the next big event happens, because during, so just after this event, another manufacturer, one of the owners of the machines, was killed. William Horsfall, his name was, that doesn't matter so much, but one of the manufacturers was killed. So you got a situation where, for the first time, the riots did not just break a machine, but somebody killed somebody. Again, this is a question which will come up again and again in social movements, because quite often the leadership will prefer that people avoid injuring or killing the opposition, well, partly because it doesn't work politically, but the leadership does not control everybody. And so then the question for the movement will often be, what shall we do now that one of our people has gone too far? What shall we do about that? That's a difficult question, I don't have the answer. That's what happened. In June, the new minister, Lord Sidmouth, the new Home Secretary, and Minister of l'Intérieur, Lord Sidmouth, set up secret committees for the examination of evidence on all this on all this thing, and they conclude that there is a huge amount of organization, very high level of organization. And they gave extra powers to the magistrates. The local magistrates had more power to stop the beginnings of these movements. Meanwhile, another parliamentary committee listened to the cotton workers, who were asking for help, really. But they had very little sympathy, and this is what they said. This is what the parliamentary committee said about the conditions of work of the cotton workers. "While the committee fully acknowledge and most deeply lament the great distress of numbers of persons engaged in the cotton manufacture, they are of the opinion that no interference of the legislature with the freedom of trade or with the perfect liberty of every individual to dispose of his time and of his labour in the way and on the terms which he may judge most conducive to his own interest can take place without violating general principles of the first importance to the prosperity and happiness of the community, without establishing the most pernicious precedent or without aggravating after a very short time the pressure of the general distress and imposing obstacles against that distress ever being removed. So very, very interesting quotation. So here you have in the purest form the idea of laissez-faire economics. So it was possible at this time in 1812, in 1812 it was possible to say, it is bad for the economy to help the poor in any organized way at all. Now, today this is politically impossible for people today. And today the argument in Britain and other countries is what kind of help is okay and what kind of help is not such a good idea. But the argument today is always about what kind of help is best for the poor. At this time it was completely possible to say helping the poor is a bad thing. So you can see very, very big change there. Notice the elements also, we call them of course riots because that's the central element here, but there are really embryonic characteristics of civil war here. When William Horsfall, who I mentioned a moment ago, was killed, for many months, according to the magistrates, no informers could be found for many months. So great was the public sympathy. So there was so much public sympathy that they couldn't find anybody. Everybody knew who it was who did it, you know, but they couldn't find anybody to tell them. In any case, in January 1813, three men were charged with the murder of Horsfall. They were all found guilty. They were hanged. They were executed. And 14 others who were involved in the attack on the mill were hanged a week later. And Lord Sidmouth said he expected the executions to have the happiest effects on various parts of the kingdom. So despite the situation, executed, as you say in French, pour exemple, yeah, despite the situation, the machine breaking continues, and they have a little bit of success in some areas. In some areas, there are small concessions which are gained. The Luddism fades away for a while, and in 1816, when the harvest is very bad, not much food around, you have another rise, and there are six people executed at this point. And William Cobbett, 1816. William Cobbett, who is the most famous radical at the time, expresses his support for his sympathy with the rioters. Although he also writes, William Cobbett is interesting because William Cobbett is the most famous radical at the time. He organizes the most famous radical newspaper at the time. I don't know who is the equivalent today. Whoever you think is the most famous radical in France today, that's him at the time in England. Okay, I won't give any names. The municipal elections are arriving and I don't want to influence it. Yeah? And you don't even live in my town, otherwise you could vote for me. Okay, he wrote Letters to the Luddites. William Cobbett wrote many, many books, but he wrote Letters to the Luddites. But really, he was the first one to accuse the Luddites of simply not liking machines. Yeah, so he sympathized with them, but he didn't really support the breaking of machines because his general ideology was that machines are wonderful. Apart from machine breaking in 1816, apart from machine breaking, you also get avec burning.
Si j'ai bien compris, il s'agit des incidents d'incendie de grange.
It's the same idea. Yeah, it's the same idea. If you don't stop using these machines, we will burn your property. That's the same idea. I'm not exactly sure what kind of ricks they burnt, you know. I'm not sure what a rick is, really. And sometimes successful. In Suffolk, the riots won a reduction in the price of flour. They managed to force the local people who were selling flour to reduce the prices because they didn't want their houses burnt. Yeah. Okay. In another place, Frome, I don't know what it is, the crowds prevented an increase in the price of potatoes. This is very, very... So it could be successful locally for a while. Interestingly enough, in the food riots, in the machine breaking, it's mostly men. But in the food riots, it tends to be mostly women organizing the food riots, partly because they're normally often responsible for the feeding of the family. So that if we continue a little bit, that again it fades away again and it comes up again. Not all of these groups necessarily use the term Luddites, but in 1821 and 1826. We get more machine breaking. Yes, I'm going through this period as for looking for machine breaking and similar. 1821, there was a revolt by rope makers, the Fabricants de Cordes. But in 1826, this was the biggest event in the 20s, in a town which is where my mother lives, in Accrington. Very important place, well, not for anything else except for the fact that my mother lives there. But in Accrington, a very big riot against power looms. So again, against a new machine, a power loom. A loom makes cloth, yeah, a loom makes cloth. Est-ce que c'est un métier à tisser ou est-ce que c'est un peu différent? I don't know, it's something like that. And the new power looms, the riots began in April 1826, and same idea. These were organized by people who worked at home with a hand loom, a métier à tisser maison, and they were opposed to the power loom, which was being used in bigger and bigger factories, and I think is still using water power. But very quickly, it may be using steam. C'est peut-être déjà la vapeur. Enfin, il faut, alors il fallait que je prépare mieux mon cours. Voilà. But power looms. And this riot involved 20,000 people. You know, 20,000 people going from factory to factory to break the machines. Yeah. So no, there's got right. We've done that one. If you have 20,000 people, you can break a lot of machines. Yeah. And of course the security guards at the factory. I mean, you know, if you are employed as a security guard and three robbers come along, yeah, you attack them. What do you do if 20,000 come along? It's this way, you know, just go right in. Yeah, not, the security guards are not stupid. Yeah, there's nothing they could do. Little by little, that went on for a few days. This was the last chance, yeah. This was the last chance in the region. This was the last chance for the hand loom weavers, the people who worked at home on a hand loom. This was their final desperate attempt to survive. The number of power looms was rising rapidly. Thousands of people unemployed, very low wages. So this was the situation. This particular group of machine breaking riots was more organized. There were trade unions involved, more organized than previously, and the leader of the weavers union in Blackburn, just up the road, wrote to the Home Secretary. He said that even workers in employment can only eat once or twice a day. Our dwellings are totally destitute of every necessary comfort. Every article of value has disappeared, either to satisfy the cravings of hunger or to appease the clamour of relentless creditors. Thousands who once looked forward with confidence to a decent competence to support themselves in old age are now reduced to the melancholy alternative of subsisting on casual charity or becoming the inmates of a workhouse. Remember the workhouses, yeah, la maison des pauvres, your only alternative if you had no money. These will be generalized in 1834, but they're already quite common in the 1820s. The government was, this was a petition he wrote to the government. The government was not... So yeah, what was his name? John Lancaster. There you go. The from the Blackburn Weavers Union, and he wrote to the Home Secretary Robert Peel. Robert Peel, very interesting. He is famous for something else. Robert Peel. He's famous for introducing the very first policeman. He invented the police, Robert Peel. Interesting idea. Again, okay. So, I'm still talking about these riots here. I've got a little story here. More than 1,000 men and women gathered on Winnie Hill near Accrington, many armed with pikes, cudgels, and sledgehammers, and marched on Sykes Highgrange Lane Mill, where they smashed 60 looms. Another group set off the Garnet and Horse Falls 5-story water-powered Clitheroe Mill. But they turned back when they were faced by a cannon outside the factory and cavalry with drawn sabres. So you can see the elements of civil war, yeah? They go to their first mill and they smash it, go to the second mill and they find that there is a cannon. Yeah, one of these big things facing them, and so they go somewhere else. The Accrington group, meanwhile, had gone to Rough Hay near Oswaldswistle, where a further 20 machines were broken. Blackburn was the next target. In Eccles, no fewer than 212 power looms were smashed. So in this particular example, this is much... so we have Nottinghamshire in 1811, 1,000 quite small stocking frames, yeah? And this is the next stage up, where you've got hundreds of big factories having their. This is where the mills, the factories are still there. The factories, they're not factories anymore, but they're still there. They're shopping centres usually. These are Victorian brick buildings, you know, solid. You know, like they're used for films when you want to make a film about a Charles Dickens novel. You know, so they're huge, beautiful buildings, and very solid, made to last. So they carry on these rioters. The soldiers arrive. Several troops of soldiers arrive from Manchester, but this did not stop the crowd from gathering again and smashing 38 machines in Darwin and 14 machines in Garsden. And notice that they had a little problem. The government had a little problem because the army, in this particular case, it's not always the case, the soldiers refused to shoot. The soldiers refused to shoot. And this is always, in any EU, extreme social movements where the level of desperation is very, very high, there is always a moment when the army either agrees to shoot or refuses to shoot, and that is the key moment. In many, many different, in China in 1989, that was the case, yeah? The students, I know you were very, very young, but the students had occupied Tiananmen Square for weeks, and the question was, will the soldiers shoot or will they refuse to shoot? And the Chinese government had to bring soldiers from 1,000 miles away, who didn't speak the same language, to be sure that they would agree to shoot. Yeah, but that's Chinese politics. But in this situation, you got the soldiers refusing to shoot, and some support for the rioters from some of the smaller factory owners. Some of the smaller factory owners supported the rioters, really, because also at this time there is almost nothing to help the poor. So people are saying, well, they are starving. Their children are dying of hunger. How can you criticize them? So there's that kind of political thing going on. I'm not going to give you the list. You have a long list of 58 looms at Edenfield. These are all the places I know, actually. Aitken and Lord, 46 machines. 38 in Ramsbottom, and so on. And it continues for a week or so. Then... as a result, in August 1826, 53 men and 12 women go in front of the High Courts. 35 men are sentenced to death, and 17 acquitted. Six of the women are sentenced to death, and four receive prison sentences. Now, in fact, none of them will be executed. None of them will be executed. All the death sentences are commuted, but a whole series of people will be sent to transportation. Interesting case again here. It's very difficult to know why. We don't have that much information. But with that level of public sympathy, the decision not to execute people it may be linked to the level of public sympathy. And just to show how desperate the people were, this is a report that says what the people said. The men answered, "We are starving now, and our children are famishing at home. We have nothing to eat and nothing to do. Speaking will fill no bellies. We will break looms, whatever the consequences. And if one half of us is shot, the other half will break looms." So that's the situation. Major social crisis. That's the 1826 situation. And again, calm for a few weeks, for a few years, until we get to the next big wave of machine breaking. Okay, the link between Nuddism and Captain Swingy's machine breaking, that they are both fundamentally machine breaking campaigns. Now, they may do other things as well, but they're fundamentally machine breaking campaigns. So we've seen then the classic Luddism of 1811, 1812, breaking stocking frames in the villages. The power loom riots in Accrington in 1826, more in the towns and much bigger factories, but still machine breaking is the tactic. Yeah. So really, it's not really that they're the same movement, but we put them together because they have the same tactics. More organized, bigger. Question.
So that Captain Swing is machine breaking campaign?
It's also machine breaking. Yes, absolutely. And a few other things. I'm now going to move on to Captain Swing, but I found a decent article in French about it, which I put up on the website. So Captain Swing is different. It's not the handloom weavers from Lancashire. It's not the stocking frame protesters from Nottinghamshire. It's fundamentally agricultural labourers. It is people who work for farmers. Now, remember that in this period you have a lot of people who have a mixed livelihood. Yet they keep a few sheep and they have a little bit of land, but that's not enough, and so they work for farmers. Yeah, or maybe they have no land, and they make a few chairs, but there's no demand, and they don't make them very well, and so they also work for farmers. Yeah, you don't have the situation today where, for the moment, most people have one employer. Captain Swing is difficult to study. It was not the only uprising, but it was the biggest one. And one of the main problems of studying it is that the labourers involved are mostly illiterate. And so they are mostly illiterate. They cannot read, they cannot write. And so when you are the historian and you want to know exactly what happens, well, it's not like if you want to know exactly what happens to in the life of Jane Austen, she writes 20 letters a day and you can read them. Yes. Sorry, I have nothing against Jane Austen. I must point this out. I keep using her as an example. Can be difficult to get the information. Where did the Captain Swing riots come from? Well, remember that there are already, at this point, very, very few peasants in Britain. Small farmers are already very rare. In France, small farmers today are having a difficult time. There are not so many small farmers as 50 years ago. But even today, you hear people, even in the university, you hear people say, "Oui, mes grands-parents étaient paysans." I have never heard anybody in England say, "My grandfather was a small farmer." Now, there must be one, but there are not many. It is extremely rare. The majority of people lived in towns in Britain in 1850. 1850, we have completely forgotten the peasant background. And agriculture was industrial agriculture very, very early. And in fact, agriculture in Britain... 1850. 1850. 10 years after 1840. Okay. This is why, you know, this is also the whole tradition of food in France is completely different. You know, you can't get in Britain. You don't get your les produits du terroir, which doesn't exist really. Yeah. Occasionally they invent them. But you know, it doesn't fundamentally exist. What does that mean? That means that a lot of the population in the villages were labourers. They worked for the big farmers. already at this period, 7,200 in 1830, 7,200 people together owned half of the land in Britain. So half of the land was divided between 7,200 people, and the other half of the land was divided among everybody else. You know. So very, very big landowners. And really, Britain is completely exceptional. Peasant farming was eliminated before the Industrial Revolution. Peasant farming was eliminated before the Industrial Revolution. This changes a lot of things in all sorts of domains. For example, in France, for a long time, folk music, the music of the village, was connected in France with rather conservative people. The idea was a fairly conservative idea, yeah? Going back to the good old ways. Let's live like we used to live in the villages was considered to be a conservative idea. Now, in Britain, because nobody remembers what peasant life was like, the idea of we need to go back to how we used to live in the villages is generally connected with protesters and left-wing people. So it's just a little detail, but you get this sociological change, and it changes everybody's view of things. This is why, you know, all the you know, the things like l'agriculture bio. Yeah. It's much more popular in Britain than in France, 100 times more popular, because there's this dream of, oh, it must have been so nice, peasant life in the villages. It probably wasn't nice at all. It sounds very, very boring to me. There you go. But that's maybe I'll have to ask my students in Agen. They probably have a different view from students in Créteil. Let me go back to the point of this. So life very, very difficult for these agricultural labourers, but you know, the people managed to live. And what was difficult also was the tides. One of the elements which was difficult was the tides. The tides is the money you pay to the church. Yeah? 10%. 10 litres, a litre how more, la dîme, Thank you. Okay. With a circumflex accent, yes I know. Right. The 10% of your money or products which you give to the church, and very often in this period it was money. It was now money. More and more was money. You know, there's less and less of any, of anything else. Furthermore, the farmers did not really want to hire labourers all year round. They didn't want to give permanent contracts. Yeah, they didn't want to give permanent contracts because the system, the very basic system for helping the poor, meant that each village was obliged to help poor people only from the village. And if you have a permanent contract in this village, then if you lose your job, you can get money from some money from the taxes in this village. So the farmers preferred to hire people for a few months, 9 months. Now, you're not from this village, you will only work here 9 months, yeah? So there's a sort of reason why you do this. So the result is that many labourers cannot find regular work. You know, they work for a few months and then they are poor for a few months. And in every village they have a poorhouse, and little by little they build the workhouses. That's the sort of situation. Am I going to talk about Spinnenland or not? Yeah, okay. The other thing, what made it a little bit more difficult was the Spinnenland system. Now, the Spinnenland system is a very basic system for helping the poor a little. And it says that when bread is expensive, the taxpayer in the village will give a little help to the poor workers. And this had a rather bad effect because the farmers reduced the wages. You know, the farmers reduce the wages because they're going to receive money help to make sure they survive. So that made things a little more difficult. Life got harder for the agricultural labourers. Difficult to know exactly how or why. Just one moment. I just need to organise this.